I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. He's a Midwestern boy in the 1970s. She's a girl living in New York 50 years earlier. They're worlds apart, yet these adventurous children seek answers and undertake quests that ultimately intertwine. Today, author, illustrator, and screenwriter Brian Selznick reveals what went into the process of turning his children's novel, Wonderstruck, into a major motion picture. Then a conversation about women and war and telling their stories. Whitney Terrell has done it in his book, The Good Lieutenant. Angela Fiddle, his consultant, has lived it in the Army during Operation Iraqi Freedom. We'll get their thoughts on the female experience of war. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Whitney Terrell was with us back in June of 2016 for a conversation about what was then his latest novel, The Good Lieutenant. Now he's back to talk about it again, as he will tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. This time, though, the focus will be on the experiences of women in war. Whitney, welcome back. So good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
With us, too, was Angela Fiddle, who was a consultant on The Good Lieutenant. She served in the Army from 2003 to 2009, including a stint as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom, too. She's now a practicing attorney here in Kansas City. And Angela, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for having me, Steve.
Whitney, your book's main character is First Lieutenant Emma Fowler. Briefly remind our listeners about where she finds herself at the beginning of this story.
Well, the book is told in reverse chronological order. So we start sort of in the middle of an IED attack that she's involved in which a couple of her soldiers die, and including a very close person she has a close relationship with named Dixon Pulowski.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, a little bit of a scary opening.
You know, you were embedded with the troops over there. I mean, why a novel? Why not a nonfiction account of what and how women in the armed services were doing over there?
Well, I think actually people have written some good nonfiction accounts. And Helen Benedict, who's going to be speaking with me tonight at the library, she has written some really good nonfiction about women's experience in war. And so has Helen Thorpe. But I'm a novelist. I like to, you know, I mean, for instance, the way that the novel goes backwards in time, it sort of it forces you to confront the way that combat affects a soldier and changes them so that they become more innocent and happier than my character, Emma, as she gets away from combat. That's not really possible in a nonfiction environment, you know. And also, you have a more control over subject matter. You have more control over what you're going to do with the characters, and you can be more interior.
Yeah. That concept of going backwards, if I recall right, came to you kind of late in the writing process, right? You were sort of flipping it around as you went, as you grasped and tried to figure out what you wanted to do.
I mean, did you read it in chronological order, Angela, or did you always read it backwards when you were helping me with the book? Do you remember?
I read it backwards. However, our first meeting, it had not yet been reversed in order yet.
So. Angela had to survive much of my period of doubt and shame about not getting this book right.
But there's a particular trick about doing it backwards, right? I mean, that's tough.
Well, I mean, I'd never written a book like that. I didn't really know for sure if you could write a book like that, although I just there was a book by Charles Baxter that I found sort of halfway through that called First Light that goes backwards. So, I mean, it just creates – it. Look, every time you're trying to write a war novel or a novel on any subject, you're trying to do something new and different. The fact that it's about a female soldier is I knew was new and different. Women were participating in the war in Iraq in ways that had never happened before and certainly didn't happen like during Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so that was new, but I did not want her story because I think the experience of women in war is different than men and the different than the narratives that we've been traditionally told about war. I also felt like the structure needed to be different, and mm-hmm. it just took me a long time to find that.
You know, Angela, you say when you arrived in Iraq that you were a low-ranking enlisted private. Where were you stationed?
I was stationed at Fort Hood, Texas at the time. That was in 2003. I got there late in the year, and then just a few months later, I was shipped out with a fresh group of troops in early 2004.
Your job title was Automated Logistics Specialist, which meant you were doing what primarily?
I know it's a really fancy way of saying we were I was working in a warehouse doing supplies, making sure that everybody on our small little like square mile base was supplied with everything they needed, like from toilet paper to weapons and
really everything. Glamorous stuff.
Yeah. Not really.
but you were also on a. You also worked on the search teams, right?
I did. Yes. Shortly after arriving there, we realized that there were a lot of other needs that the troops had that our support battalion could provide support on. One of them being female search personnel. So that meaning whenever all of our cavalry guys were out doing their missions outside the wire, as they called they found that since it's an urban setting and a lot of the missions involved dealing with regular people, people with wives and with children, and they felt that it would be most appropriate to have a female soldier there to physically search women and children for weapons and post guard on them during the operations. So that was something that, you know, at first they took volunteers and, you know, there weren't very many of us volunteering to go on these missions. But I was one of the few that,
Were you with lots of other women at the time or were many of them officers?
In what capacity? On these search missions?
Yeah, exactly. And in the warehouse.
No, on the search missions, I would be the only female. They would rotate through a handful of us, and they would just bring one female with them. In fact, I would be accompanied with a higher ranking non-commissioned officer, but that was always a male.
Mm-hmm.
So from my unit. I did work with a lot of females. Supply is a job that that tends to be heavy and with females. So I worked with a lot of them in the warehouse. Although I did not have a female lieutenant, ours was male. So, but they were around.
Yeah. How did you find Angela, and why did you want her to be consultant for the book here?
Well, I mean, first of all, she was my wife's student, and she's a UMKC graduate.
Okay.
So through the power of our great university, I found
her.
And thanks to my wife, Gail Levy. I felt like, look, this is a hard book to write. I was not in the military, although I was embedded. But you want to fact check everything, and you want to ask also just to how it felt, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to a lot of women and asked them to read the book to make sure that I was getting things right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just doing due diligence in essence, you
right.
know. And it was a real joy actually talking to Angela about stuff, you know, how stuff felt.
I mean, how did you do it? I mean, did you consult with Angela on details as you were writing, or did you give her a complete draft to look over, or all of that?
Do you remember? I mean, we would meet and I would like have a notebook full of questions and I'd be like, could this happen? Could this happen?
Yeah.
Could this happen?
It was just talking over about things at first. And it was really exciting kind of feeding off of, and he would bring something up in questioning and I would get really excited about it. And he would probably make a mental note to include it in the novel. And, at the very end, he did provide a draft of what he had written, and I read the whole thing. And just at that point, it was really just tweaking the tiniest details that would stand out to a service member, so that
Do you remember one that you picked on?
Yes, there was a scene that took place. It was right before they were shipping to go out to Iraq, and they were waiting in their gym where they're on lockdown, which is an experience that I am absolutely familiar with. But there's a scene where she's watching, and she has a moment where she fidgets with her hat on her head, and I said, no, there's no way she's got a hat on right now.
Good.
She's inside of a gym.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Because in the military, we don't wear headgear inside of buildings ever.
Come on, Whit. You should have known that. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Hey, I got a lot of stuff to pay attention to in that scene.
what did you think when he first asked you to help out with the book?
Oh, well, I thought it was an honor. You know, I... for me. I don't, you know, everyone's experience is so different. I find it hard to, it's a lot of pressure to think that you're, you know, you're representing an entire, you know, the female military perspective. But I thought it was an honor. I thought it was a great idea. You know, if I had his talents, I wish I could write my own novel about my experience. So
be my guest.
It's all yours. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm talking with Whitney Terrell and Angela Fiddle. Whitney will be at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library this evening with fellow author Helen Benedict to present Women and War. The program begins at 6:30. More information at kclibrary.org. Angela, our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan was really the first military action I can recall seeing women soldiers carrying full gear and rifles out on patrol. You did that during your tour. I'm wondering, what other kinds of missions were you involved in?
So you end up doing a lot of different, or carrying a lot of different responsibilities. I mean, there was my regular job, which working in the warehouse. I mean, we're working 12-hour shifts every day. You know, there's no vacation in a combat zone.
Seven days a week.
But my only break from that was getting to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and go out on cordon and search missions.
How nerve-wracking were those?
Be honest.
They weren't. I'd have to say they were exciting. You get really revved up. You get really amped. You spend a lot of time waiting in line and in your convoy, waiting for things to start. And they're like blasting loud music, and everyone's getting excited and getting each other pumped up for. Usually, I mean, nothing ever really exciting happened on these missions. I'd have to say
in case something might happen, you were getting amped up. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So all the adrenaline's pumping. You go out and then. Usually nothing very eventful actually happened. I'd have to say I saw a lot more action on the base than I did outside of it.
In what sense?
I did work as a gate guard, so that was a duty that kind of got rotated around, and I got selected for that a couple of times. And we did take on fire there. We did receive I don't even remember what they're, but like rocket launchers, RPGs. We were getting attacked when we were working the gates. So
you never told me that. That's a new one for me. There's little stuff in there that.
So a lot of this stuff is something that has been boxed up for quite some time. So I'd have to say that working with Whitney on this has kind of been an exercise for me and really
purging,
opening up.
Yeah,
I'm not
going
to make you tell the stories, but some of those cordon and search missions, according to the notes that I have, were rougher than she's making them sound. My personal
in what opinion. Sense, Whit? What do you recall from your conversation?
How far are we going to go with this, Angela?
Yeah. So I think I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
There was a time when I first got there and we were having. When my unit first arrived and we were starting to take over all of the raid missions, there was one that I recall where we were working with special forces, and a lot of these missions, I had no idea what was going on. Like I said, I was just a private, and not only was I just a private, I wasn't even part of the, the cavalry units that were that were really primarily tasked with the mission. I was just tagging along as their
but what happened?
Babysitter. But at one point, one of the guys that was with Special Forces, and I believe he's with Special Forces just based on the way that his uniform looked, and he had a beard and everything. So that's what we understood. And he spoke Arabic. So the conversations he was having with the family at the house that we were raiding it was in Arabic, and they weren't happy. I think that from what I observed, because, I mean, these guys completely tore apart this house, these people's house, like just everything from floor to ceiling was just knocked over. And And, you know, we left quite a mess behind us mm-hmm. when we did leave. But I think at some point they had found a handgun in the household somewhere, and so they weren't very happy about it. So and
the soldiers weren't very happy about it.
Yes, the soldiers mm-hmm. weren't very happy about it. And so I don't know exactly what the involvement of the wife and there was two children there. There was maybe about a teenage girl and then a younger little boy that was maybe, I don't know, 6 years old. But I was ordered to detain the mother, the mm-hmm. older lady. And so I went and got my little cuffs out and started to put them on her. And the teenage daughter got really upset and she started yelling. And I think she kind of tried to get in between me and the mother. And so then I was instructed to detain her as well. And so when I turned on her, she ran away from me and I ended up having to chase her down. I remember slamming her against a wall and pinning her down. Yeah.
Tough?
Yes. So things that, you know, things that you're not really proud of when you look back on your, me specifically.
What did you, during your time there, did you meet many female soldiers?
I did. The primary one was a woman named Jen McDonough, who's now a lieutenant colonel based in Hawaii. And she really had the same exact job that Emma did. She was with a support unit in the same way that Angela was, but she was a captain.
Yeah.
And I would just say that also, you know, Helen Benedict's novel Wolf Season, which we'll also be talking about, is set mostly in the States. So, but it's about a character Rin confronting a memory just like the one that Angela talked mm-hmm. through. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, those stories remain inside of you, and they affect. You can tell how it's emotional for her to tell that story.
Even now, yeah,
they really matter, and that is something that fiction can also do.
Well, what was your sense of how the women you met with viewed their roles in the war? Did you come away with anything?
Well, I felt that they were really proud mm-hmm. of what they had done, and they recognized that they had done something that had not been done by women before, and they also recognized that they'd survived a very difficult and often, frankly, discriminatory experience mm-hmm. being women in a massively male organization. And the ones who made it through, people like Angela and
Angela's
and
nodding her head as you're saying
and
that,
Stacey
by the way.
Moore yeah. and Jen McDonough are tough. They're adaptive. They know that they have been, in certain sense, treated unfairly by the military, and they've said, screw it, we're gonna make it through anyway, and they did. And I think that shapes really powerful people.
Angela, discriminatory how? I can only begin to imagine, but what would you point to?
I had mentioned working on gate guard and taking on fire, enemy fire. There was one particular night where we were out. It was myself and five other soldiers. I was the only female. There were six of us, and we were out on the furthest checkpoint from that we manned outside of the gate for a night shift of gate guard. And when we started receiving gunshots from somewhere, we couldn't even really tell. It was nighttime. Mm-hmm. It was completely dark, and all you could see was that we were receiving gunshots. And the highest ranking person there said for everyone to set up and return fire, except for me. I was instructed to hide.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Really? How'd you feel about that?
I wasn't very happy about it, especially considering that I was probably the only person in that group that had an expert marksmanship badge.
No kidding. Such a classic story.
No,
and on Veterans Day, this is also important. I mean, we're doing this reading in celebration of Veterans Day, which just passed. But, you know, Angela was just telling me a story just exactly. Do you want to tell that story
oh,
about
sure.
your...
yeah.
Oh, that... we just had a Veterans Day, and... you know, I'm really fortunate to be in this wonderful group of people on a bodybuilding team here in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And that morning there was a message in our team group chat that, you know, wanted to thank all of the veterans on the team, named about three of the males that are on the team. And
not you.
Not me. And so I said, you know, hey, let's not forget all of our female veterans, too, on the team. And then it was like, oh, you know, sorry, it completely slipped my mind. And, you know, it's unfortunately, I'm sure it was just a simple mistake on his part. But, you know, it's also something that I'm used to is being overlooked as a military person.
We're going to leave our conversation there. Angela Fiddle's an attorney in Kansas City. She served in the Army as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom 2. Thanks to your service. Thanks for coming in today, Angela. So nice to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Whitney Terrell is the author of The Good Lieutenant and appears tonight with Helen Benedict at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library for Women and War. It all begins at 6:30. For more information, go to kclibrary.org. Whit, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to see you.
Time for a break. When we come back, Brian Selznick, the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret and a whole bunch more books, big bestsellers, will be here with us as well. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we learned about how the state government in Kansas resists at almost every level efforts to expand public disclosure. And we spoke with psychologist Wes Crenshaw about divorce and co-parenting. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Tomorrow, we've got Kansas City, Missouri Police Chief Rick Smith in to talk about his approach to community policing and what we can expect from his department. We'll also be joined by Leland Shuren, who's head of the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Brian Selznick is back on the big screen. The author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret is just seeing his mega bestseller, Wonderstruck, converted to a movie that's just opened across the country. Selznick is known for his mixture of great storytelling and great artwork, all from his pen. Wonderstruck is about two 12-year-old runaways, a girl in 1927 and a boy in 1977. Both are deaf, and both stories merge at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. The great filmmaker Martin Scorsese made a film out of Hugo Cabret. Now it's director Todd Haynes' turn with Wonderstruck. These are heady times for author Brian Selznick, who will be in town for a screening of Wonderstruck on Saturday. More on that in just a few minutes. He joins us now from the studios of NPR in New York. And Brian, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi there. So happy to be back.
You wrote the screenplay for Wonderstruck, and now the movie is out. For a lot of authors, seeing their books transform can be difficult, stunning, awkward. But you illustrate your books so lavishly that I'm wondering if seeing it up in the big screen wasn't all that much of a stretch.
Well, I definitely know what everything looks like when I'm making my books because I do so many drawings. But one of the thrills of having these two movies made was seeing the story that I made up through these brilliant director's eyes, seeing Hugo through Martin Scorsese's eyes and seeing Wonderstruck through Todd Haynes' eyes. And I've been a fan of Todd's since his first movie, Poison, came out in 1991. And so he's a real visionary. And so it makes me feel a little bit like a proud parent.
So how did the movie come out? How happy with it are you?
I'm really happy. I feel incredibly lucky because both of the films are very, very faithful to the book. I didn't really have anything to do with the making of the movie of Hugo other than I got to read the script a couple of times, which was brilliantly adapted by John Logan, and I got to visit the set, and I saw how closely they were sticking to what I had written. And then on the set of Hugo, I met the costume designer Sandy Powell, and she and I became friends, and it was actually her idea for me to adapt Wonderstruck and to give it to Todd Haynes, who she's collaborated with as well many times on Far From Heaven and Velvet Goldmine and Carol with Todd Haynes. And so writing my first screenplay, I was able to talk with John Logan, who I also had become friends with, and John gave me some pointers on how to help make a story work for the screen. But again, it's incredibly faithful, so it feels both like it's mine and it's not mine at the same time. It now belongs to Todd Haynes and Sandy, who did the costumes for this, and Mark Friedberg, who did the brilliant production design, and Carter Burwell, whose score is just gorgeous, and Ed Lockman, legendary cinematographer who made the movie look like it was made in the 70s and the 20s.
Mm-hmm. So what's the trick of transforming a novel into a screenplay? What was the hardest thing for you to figure out?
Well, you know, you were saying that the books I do are illustrated, so that actually gives me a leg up when I'm when I was writing the screenplay, because I was able to visualize it. And actually, film has always been an influence on the creation of these books. Even when I was making Hugo, I wanted the book to feel like a silent movie, even though when I was making the movie, I didn't think the story itself could be adapted. But the way a director like Alfred Hitchcock or Francois Truffaut or even Scorsese in the end, who uses the camera almost like a character, so that you you're helped to understand the narrative through what the camera itself is doing. That's always been an influence on the way I've looked at illustrations, as well as work like, you know, Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, where he has the famous wild rumpus, where there's no more text, there's no more white space. It's just the drawings that we move page by page through. And so being able to think about those elements was very, very helpful. And so much of John Logan's notes to me were about condensing the story. So in the book, Wonderstruck takes place over the course of about a week, I would say. And John said, make it happen in a single night.
Wow.
And if there's, you know, four clues as to who the boy's missing father is, pick one. And his first note to me when I gave him my first draft of the screenplay was cut the first 50 pages in half.
Really?
And that was probably the hardest note of all. And it took me about a month and a half or 2 months to do that. And he wouldn't let me stop until I actually got it down to 25 pages, those first 50. But every time, you know, it's incredibly painful every time you have to cut something, but then every time something goes, you feel how it tightens up overall, and and you know, it's the screen definitely demands a certain movement that a book will can wait on. Books now, don't mind if you wait.
I've always found that, you know, writing, and in your case, writing and illustrating is tough work, but rewriting for me has always been even harder, because you have this initial vision you're trying to get out, and then suddenly it's getting tossed out or dramatically reworked, and that's hard.
Yeah, well, my husband, who's an academic, always says that writing is rewriting.
Amen. I mean, yeah. You know, I try to tell that to my students, and that's just an idea that's completely lost on them at first, you know?
Yeah, well, I remember in fifth grade when we started learning about rewrites, I specifically recall feeling like there was no reason to rewrite anything, because once I had written it, I was done.
I was done, yeah.
And so it's hard to lose that initial feeling. And I know when I talk to kids when I go to schools, or bookstores, you know, I definitely hear that same sentiment from kids. But I know for myself now, it takes me 3 years to make these books. And I do have certain elements that appear early on that stick with me throughout the 3 years of writing. But really, it's about crafting the narrative, the story, the plot, the emotional arc of the characters. And then, of course, the drawings themselves throughout it. So in a way, you know, when it was time to do the screenplay, I had felt like I had, you know, it was just like another step in the process in a certain way. And when I make a book, they're designed very much to be books. They're designed so that they're about the interaction between the words and the pictures. Why are there words and pictures? What happens when you turn the page? What happens when you open the book? What's the feeling of that, the weight of the book in your hand? And when it's time to make a film, it's a matter of thinking about how the general narrative arc, which was designed to be in the book form, can be shifted so that it feels like it was always meant to be a film. And I guess it was relatively easy with Hugo, in that Hugo is very much about the history of film. And even in Wonderstruck, there are elements of silent movies as part of the plot.
Right.
But right away, when I was beginning the screenplay, I was thinking about the words and the pictures in the book because in Wonderstruck, the story of this girl who's born deaf and is 12 years old in 1927 is told entirely in drawings so that it both feels like a silent movie and it parallels mm-hmm. the way a deaf person experiences the world, which is mostly visually. And then the story of Ben in 1977, who becomes deaf when he's 12, is told entirely in written language, in words. So those two go back and forth. But when I was writing the screenplay, I knew I was going to lose the words and the pictures that I had in the book because everything has to be yes. images in a movie. And so I thought I could tell the story of Rose in 1927 like a black and white silent movie. And we would think it's black and white and silent because of the time period, but we would come to understand its silence is a way of paralleling the experience of the main character who yeah. we discover is deaf. And then I thought we could film 1977 like a color film made in the 70s. So I actually sort of pictured it starting off like McCabe and Mrs. Miller by Robert Altman, because my story opens in Minnesota. But then Ben goes to New York in 1977. So I sort of imagined it becoming Mean Streets for kids.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Brian Selznick is my guest. He's the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, and we're talking about the transition of his mega bestseller, Wonderstruck, into a movie that's now out. And he'll be presenting Wonderstruck at 3:30 on Saturday at the Tivoli Cinemas in Westport. This is a benefit for The Rabbit Hole. There will be an introduction by Brian, followed by a Q&A after the film. Tickets are available through Eventbrite. Again, that's on Saturday at 3:30 at the Tivoli in Westport. If you want to join our conversation, you want to have a question for Brian and his wonderful work over the years, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. We were talking about rewriting. Do you ever redraw, Brian?
All the time. When I'm developing a story, I actually first write down a list of what I think I want the drawings to be. Then I do little thumbnail sketches that are actually about the size of my thumb, pretty small.
Really?
And then I'll Xerox them, I'll cut them out, I'll glue these little drawings together and make little booklets, like these little dummies, so I can see how the pages turn. And then as I'm doing that, I realize that in order to understand the narrative, because I will usually have the narrative move forward through the illustration. So the text will bring us to a certain point, and then the narrative will either pick up or be told with pictures. And so by actually being able to flip through the miniature booklet that I'm making, I'm able to see if I need another drawing or if I have too many drawings. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I will need to readjust.
Well, what's harder for you, the drawing or the writing?
I think in pictures. So in a way, I'm imagining what things look like first, but I always write before I draw. And then when I write what I want the drawings to be, I have a pretty clear idea of what the composition is going to be and what the movement of the image is going to be. But when I'm writing, I find it much harder to pick the correct language all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I find writing much, much, much harder.
Much harder, it sounds like. Yeah. Whole lot harder. Yeah.
A whole lot harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I love writing. Like, I love what language can do. And what's interesting is that when you look at one of these books, anyone who reads the books will end up with the same narratives. But if you were to ask someone to describe what's happening in the picture story, each person would use different language than every other person. And anyone asked to draw images from the story that's told in text would draw a different picture than anybody else. So these two different ways of telling a story are crisscrossing inside each of the reader's minds, doing different things. And part of what I hope is fun about reading the books is the way that these two stories interact in the reader's head. Because, in the book of Wonderstruck, you've got The one story in 1927 in pictures, like I said, and then the other ones in text in 1927. But there'll be these moments across time where similar things will be happening. Like the Ben in 1977 becomes deaf when he's on the phone and the house gets hit by lightning, right. And the lightning goes through the wire and hits him in the right. through the phone, which can actually happen. But I wanted to draw lightning, but there's no drawing in his section. It's just language. And so I put lightning into Rose's story in 1927 so that I could draw lightning. And in, for her, I put lightning in a movie theater, in a movie, so that she could go to a movie and then see lightning. And then I just worked it out so that the moment she's in the movie theater seeing the lightning, it's the same moment in the other story
yeah.
that Ben right. is struck.
Wow, wow. You know, you mentioned you spend 3 years on these big books that you do. Hugo Cabret was the first one, I believe, that you did that way. I'm wondering, how did you handle the pressure of not knowing whether this genre-busting sort of approach that you took to that book was going to work or not? Because you really blew out the industry with this thing.
Well, it turned out thinking the book was not going to be read by anybody was very helpful. It was very, in a way, it was very freeing because that story began as a novella. I thought it was going to be a 98-page novella.
Like your other books have been, relatively yeah. short. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Much shorter books.
More conventional books, yeah.
Yeah. My first book was 48 pages.
Right, right.
The Houdini Box. And so I as I was working, I began to think about the way movies tell their stories, like we were talking about, and the way picture books tell their stories, like Where the Wild Things Are. And so I went back and I took out sections of text and replaced them with these illustrated sequences. And so, for instance, I had a 3-page description of what the train station was like, and then I removed that and replaced it with 48 pages of pictures that essentially tell the same amount of information. But because of the number of pictures it takes to replace the language, the book grew from 98 pages to about 550.
Which we had never seen before. No one had ever seen anything like this before.
And it was a book about French silent movies,
yes,
and, which,
right.
you know, kids don't watch.
Right.
And so I basically spent the 3 years very excited about the story I was telling, but pretty convinced that there was a really good chance nobody was going to read it. But my editor, Tracy Mack at Scholastic, said something very helpful to me, which was, if the reader cares about your main character, they'll care about what the main character cares about.
Mm-hmm.
And if Hugo cares about silent movies and the reader cares about Hugo, the reader will care about silent movies. And that's very much what happened. So pretty much from the minute the book was published and I started going to schools and I saw the way kids were reacting to the book, I saw that they were embracing Hugo, and also I wasn't sure if the reader would be able to understand how the pictures go back and forth, but the story goes back and forth between the pictures and the text, and I actually wrote into the story an explanatory opening that essentially tells the reader how to read the book,
huh.
And they got it. You know, they got it really, really quickly. And so with Wonderstruck, I knew I could just jump right in to the two narratives and trust that the readers would be able to figure out how to read the book.
So with Hugo Cabret, were you showing up at family functions like at Thanksgiving and people were saying, hey, you know, Brian, what are you working on right now? And you'd say, well, this 550-page book on this silent film thing. And were they looking at you like you had 18 eyeballs, or how did that work?
Well, it certainly didn't sound very promising.
Very nice, Brian. We'll have a nice year. We'll see you next year. Yeah,
exactly. You know, yeah. like, you know, French silent movies and Georges Méliès, and there
yes.
was, there's a lot of obscure things that I'm interested in. And even in Wonderstruck, there's all of this information about the history of museums and cabinets of wonder and very, very, complex information about deaf culture and the way deaf people communicate, which a lot of this stuff, if a student is going to learn about it, is it's all things that they don't learn about maybe till college or even grad school. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking these things that are fascinating to me that are, you know, if they're taught at all, they're taught at the uppermost levels of, you know, education, and then making them understandable and interesting for kids. And in so many ways that also, I think, then makes it accessible to just the general reader, whatever their age is, mm-hmm. because what I'm doing is I'm giving a context. And I think that's what stories are, is they're a way of giving us context so that we can see things in a different way and help us understand things that we might otherwise not understand or learn about things we might not otherwise want to learn about.
Brian Selznick is my guest, author, screenwriter, illustrator. His books, The Invention of Hugo Cabret and Wonderstruck, which is now a major motion picture. Again, he'll be in town on Saturday at the Tivoli Cinemas in Westport at 3:30 Saturday for a benefit for the Rabbit Hole. He'll do a Q&A after the film. Tickets are available through Eventbrite. You know, Brian, tell us again the story about when did you know for pretty much sure that Hugo Cabret was going to be a hit? Because, again, this thing came out of nowhere. Was it when you were at schools, or was there a sales report you got and you remember that day for the rest of your life?
Well, I will say there was no expectations on Hugo. And so when I finished the work and I handed it into my editor at Scholastic, I saw that everyone at Scholastic was really excited about the book, and that was very promising. That was very nice, but even that doesn't guarantee the book is going to do well. But I certainly appreciated the fact that everybody was so excited about it at Scholastic. But it really was my first day on the first event of my tour for The Invention of Hugo Cabret. I went into a school, and I got there a little early to set up my PowerPoint presentation. I was going to show a slideshow about making the book.
Right.
And a class came in early, and they had gotten early copies of the book so that they were able to read it for my event. And there was a kid sitting in the front row clasping the book to their chest like it was a treasure.
Yes.
And I remember seeing that, and I almost started crying.
I bet.
And I thought to myself, don't let the kids see you cry, Brian. but seeing the way that kid was holding that book and loving that book made me think that things were going to be okay.
And you'll remember that kid for the rest of your life, probably.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to Wonderstruck and the new film. Run us through the plot here. You've talked about it a little bit here. Don't give away the ending, but give us just a rough sense of it.
Yeah, so it's these two intertwining stories. This girl, Rose, in 1927, who was born deaf, and she's living with this father, and she's being forced to lip read and speak and not allowed to learn any sign language or anything, doesn't even know any other deaf people, which is very much what deaf education was like at the time in 1927. And she's very unhappy and she feels very cut off, but she's obsessed with this silent movie actress named Lillian Mayhew, and she discovers that Lillian is going to be on stage in New York in a play, so she runs away to go see her idol.
That's very much a Brian Selznick creation. It's so you.
Yes.
Who else would go there except you? Yeah. You know.
Yes, I do have certain interests that keep coming back, and then that story weaves with a story in 1977 about this boy named Ben, who's never known his father, and his mom dies in an accident, and he discovers a clue that says that his dad might have been in New York City at some point. And so he runs away to New York City just after he has become deaf from this lightning strike accident. And he sets off to go try to find this father who he's never met. And there's all these places throughout the two stories where there's these sort of uncanny connections between the two of them, where both children end up at the Museum of Natural History, both children end up at the meteorite. And, you know, when I was putting the story together, it was a matter of working in so many of my favorite places around New York, like the Wolf Diorama at the Museum of Natural History, which plays a very important role, and the Panorama, which is at the Queens Museum, which was built for the 1964 World's Fair, and it's a 895,000 building model of all of New York City, 10,000 square feet, that you can still go see. And when we made the movie, we were able to actually film at the Museum of Natural History. We were able to film on the panorama. And that was a real thrill.
The film opens with wolves.
Yes. Yes, the Ben has been dreaming of these wolves that have been chasing him. Mm. And I don't think this is giving too much away, but when he gets to the museum, there's a really uncanny moment where he sees the wolf diorama.
Right.
I had grown up loving the wolf diorama myself. But when I started making this book, I really for the first time went and read the wall tag next to the wolf diorama. And it said that it's a scene from an area called Gunflint Lake. And so I looked up Gunflint Lake and I discovered, it's actually an artist's colony. And there's there are illustrators who live there and glass blowers and fabric artists. And
Did you wind up going there?
Oh yeah, I found the information for the librarian in Gunflint Lake, and I wrote to her and introduced myself, and she invited me to come out with my husband, and we spent an amazing weekend walking around Gunflint Lake. And you know, Ben's mother in the book was a librarian, so in a way I felt like I ended up meeting the real version of this person who I was in the process of making up. But whenever I can, I do try to travel to the places I'm writing about.
You know, Brian, it just strikes me, listening to you talk, that you've got to retain in your work, you've got to retain this ability to think like a kid and what interests a kid. And I'm wondering, how do you do that in your life?
I don't know. I just think it so happens that I am still interested in all of the things that interested me when I was a kid, you know, movies and museums and monsters and, you know, all of the drawing. And like, there's all of these things that were very important to me when I was a kid, miniatures that are still very important to me. And I also have this theory that everybody has an essential age, that we're all born with an age that we are in our souls. Because sometimes you meet a four-year-old who seems like they're 60, and you know.
That's true.
And sometimes you meet a 25-year-old who seems like they're 8. You know, like we just have and I think my essential age is around 10. It's around 10. Mm-hmm. And I remember being 10 very strongly. And it's not a matter of maturity or immaturity. It's a matter of what age we identify with. And I think a lot of high school teachers are themselves. There's something about the teenage years that's essential to them.
Right.
I know, like, you know, people look back on their middle school years with horror, but there are people who teach middle school and love it.
Right.
And I think that's because there's something about that age that connects with them in some fashion.
Hey, before you scoot, I got to ask you quickly, you just have 30 seconds left, about Millicent Simmons, the young girl who plays Rose. She's also deaf in real life. She's so expressive, and I'm just guessing here, when she auditioned, you know, was she the pick to play the role after about, what, 3 seconds, or how did that work?
Yeah, we had 500 audition tapes, and
no,
the minute we saw Millie's audition tape, we all cried, and we knew that she was Rose.
Wow. Didn't take long, eh?
No, she was it.
You can see Brian Selznick on Saturday at 3:30 at the Tivoli, a benefit for the Rabbit Hole. More information and tickets, Eventbrite. Brian Selznick, the author of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, the author of Wonderstruck. Thanks so much for your time. Always great to have you here.
All right, my pleasure.
You bet. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, Kansas City's police chief, who's been on the force for 3 months, on the job for 3 months, discusses his approach to community policing and what's next for the department. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produce this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.